Clerk will call the docket.
West Harbor County Construction Workers Association, Christopher I. Cockrell, Robert J. Aon, a fellow council, Thomas K. Fochon Jr., and Stephen M. Connelly.
Wait just one moment. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Again, my name is Robert Sinkar, and I hope to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
At issue in this case is the refusal of the Loudoun Circuit Court to enforce an arbitration clause in a contract for the construction of a custom pipe. The arbitration clause appears in the joint appendix on page 20, and it really includes three parts. The first part is the agreement to arbitrate itself, which reads, any controversy or claim arising out of or relating to this contract or the breach thereof shall be settled by arbitration. Under this case, this court's precedence, parties have chosen the broadest language for their agreement to arbitrate. This means that any contract-related dispute, however it's labeled, is to go to arbitration. Now, at this point, the parties could have stopped there, and that would have been a perfectly effective arbitration clause. But they didn't, and they had two other parts that described the shape of the arbitration that they were contemplating. The first is that it would be administered by the Better Business Bureau. And then the second is, and this is the clause that brings us here, is that it would be administered by the Better Business Bureau under its construction industry arbitration rules. And the issue, of course, is that there are no construction industry arbitration rules written by the Better Business Bureau, and there never have been.
But they've been adopted periodically over the course of time by the Better Business Bureau. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, indeed. They have their own general rules for arbitration, but then if there are specialized rules, they adopt them regularly. That's their practice. The dispute arose after the Alexanders had moved into their home concerning the functioning of a certain system, and ultimately led to this lawsuit. Within a little over 2 weeks after the suit was filed, Brush Arbor demanded that arbitration be done to resolve the dispute, and the counsel for Alexanders rejected it, arguing that apparently had discovered that, in fact, there were no and never have been any construction industry arbitration rules, and so he claimed that the doctrine of impossibility made the arbitration clause a nullity. And ultimately, in adjudicating a motion to compel arbitration, the circuit court adopted that analysis. Now, there's two critical outcome determinative errors in the circuit court's ruling in this case. And the first is simply that the circuit court itself should not have resolved this matter. The precedents are legion, and we've cited them in our briefs, that any question like this, whether a question of procedure or of arbitrability, under this court's precedents and indeed general precedents concerning arbitration, should have gone to the arbitrator. So that was error number one. That's outcome determinative. And frankly, I could stop there and sit down and say, we win, folks, and that's it. But the other issue, which I think I would urge the court to consider here, is how the circuit court addressed the merits question. And what the circuit court said was this was indeed an issue of impossibility. Now, in point of fact, the doctrine of impossibility does not apply here, because the doctrine of impossibility, as this court well knows, relies on the notion of the parties expect an event during the course of contract performance to occur or not occur. Common example in one of the court's old cases is an iron ore deposit that's supposed to exist during the course of performance of the contract. And so suddenly this event, which was expected not to occur, in the example I gave, the running out of the iron ore, occurs, and the doctrine of impossibility says in that situation, contract is impossible to perform, and so the contract is at an end. So the remedy for impossibility is the end of the contract. The reason why I say I would respectfully ask the court to address this question is because how the circuit court got to that result was by relying on an old case from this court, Haddock versus Mason. And it's a confusedly written opinion, and there, frankly, in the past, not only in this state but in others, the words used to describe the doctrine of mutual mistake and impossibility have often been interchanged, so the principles get muddy. And you can read that opinion to go any other way. But the fact is that this court's other precedents, which we did cite to the court, including the more recent one from 2016, which is the Hampton Roads Bankshare case, where this court cited the restatement of contracts, is very clear about the doctrine of impossibility. And here it couldn't apply because the rules that we're talking about never existed. And in impossibility, as with the iron ore deposit, the iron ore was there, you have a contract to mine it and so forth, so it just doesn't fit. So I think that confusion, even if the court does grant reversal here, I think it could be cleared up very easily. Haddock can be read.
The remedy issue turns on it, doesn't it? I mean, you can fix a mutual mistake of fact. You can't fix impossibility. You can't reform the agreement to make it not impossible.
Correct. That's exactly right. And that's one of the reasons why. So the remedy is much more draconian in for impossibility. But the only other choice here is mutual mistake. And that can't apply here because remember that the doctrine of mutual mistake is the doctrine of mutual mistake of material fact. And material means that that fact influenced the decision-making of one of the parties here. And so logically, since these rules never existed, you can't say that they shaped the thinking of the party.
On that point, if we agree with your premise about impossibility, would we say as a matter of law there's a mutual mistake, or would we need to remand for the trial court to figure out if there was such a mistake? In other words, here's some kind of evidence, and then fashion a remedy.
Well, I mean, the court below did not address that question, so my guess would be a remand, but I would say that the opposite is actually true, Your Honor, that you could not, as a matter of law, have the doctrine of mutual mistake apply here, because just logically, how can something that didn't exist have been a material fact in the decision-making of a party? So
you're saying there was inescapably a mutual mistake of fact on the existence of these rules?
Well, there's a mistake of fact, but for the doctrine...
But it's not material.
It's not material, correct.
Right.
Yeah, and so for the doctrine to apply, you have to have materiality, and logically, how on earth could this be material?
Let me give you a hypothetical, see how you respond to that. I don't read anything into it, I just want to know what your position is.
Yes, sir.
If the contract said that arbitration will take place before Fred Jones, and Fred Jones dies before the issue of arbitration comes about, what would be your position on whether that sufficed for impossibility of performance, or whether or not the matter should then simply go to the arbiter or to the judge, and that's part of my question, for determination as to whether or not arbitration could nonetheless be compelled with somebody else?
Well, I think, Your Honor, there's two questions in there, really. And so, first of all, I think I believe it's the Schuling case that this court ruled on, that because of the Virginia statute that allows the court to replace an arbitrator, that if the parties have chosen one and suddenly, because the person died, you don't have the arbitrator, then the court can appoint one. So I would say that doesn't render it impossible, and indeed the General Assembly acted to make sure that couldn't be an impossibility. That's how strong the policy in favor of arbitration is. But also, I think the second point that you make in terms of who should decide that, the case that we submitted to the court yesterday, the Schein case that just came down from the Supreme Court, and there, some of the courts of appeals had applied a doctrine that said if a claim of arbitrability is wholly groundless, you know, it doesn't make any sense, the court can go ahead and decide that. And the Supreme Court said no, if you have an arbitration agreement that all these issues are supposed to be decided by the arbitrator, even if it looks obvious that there's no basis for arbitration, the arbitrator is still the person that's supposed to decide it.
One of the factors that we used in Schuling was the severability clause, that the provision with regard to a particular arbitration group could drop out because of severability, and then the contract would fill the void, or the statute would fill the void. Here there is no severability clause, and in the chief's hypothetical, if it is not severable, and if the parties agree on a specific arbitrator, does that change the facts of the application of Schuling?
I realize, Your Honor, that there's that attribute in Schuling, and logically I don't see why it would, frankly, because if, as in Schuling, you have the General Assembly statute that provides a mechanism for a remedy of providing another arbitrator. Obviously, if a person's named, that's as specific as you can get. Both parties were very happy and wanted that, but nevertheless, the General Assembly said that the court can step in and appoint another arbitrator. That obviously isn't this case, I don't believe, but I think that's how I would answer it. With that, I see I'm into my 5 minutes. I'm sorry.
One very brief question.
Yes,
the contract and this this provision in particular was drafted entirely by your client?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Never was specifically negotiated? It was just simply signed?
Well, I mean, the whole contract was provided to the other party.
But this particular provision was not the subject of discussion?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Frankly, there's been no discovery or factual development on that point, so I don't think so, but that's about as best that I can say right now.
Thanks.
Okay.
You have 3 minutes and 50 seconds remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Tom Plufton. I hail for Loudoun County, and I represent the Alexanders in this case. With me this morning is Jessica McCollum. She co-wrote the brief with me, and she's here for argument. If I could, as a brief clerical correction, I wanted to inform the Court, because it was raised in the reply brief by Brush Arbor. When we cited our standard of review on our brief at page 17, we indicated that the decision of the existence of a contract was an issue of fact, or was a question of fact. And we cited Stonega, Koch, and Cole at 136 Virginia 489. We pin cited to 495, and the pin site should be 494. And the actual quote of the court is whether or not there was such a contract in existence was a simple question of fact. So to the extent that that causes any undue effort, we apologize in that regard. We've raised eight different issues, one part being two parts on this issue. The first is that we believe that the court needs to look at this and the standard of whether or not there is an adequate transcript that allows the court to make a decision in this particular case. And we don't believe that under the court's rulings in Towler and the Court of Appeals rulings in Roberts, Rule 511 was not complied with, and there is no transcript of the underlying hearing. And I think that that's important because not only does it mean that the court doesn't have a complete record, but the issues that the Brush Arbor has raised are dependent on a lot of what was decided or what was determined by the trial court at the hearing in January of 2018.
But the problem with that, from his perspective, is that his argument is that the whole question is a question for the arbitrator to decide. What are the construction rules? Do we borrow the AAA? How do we handle this? Do we have any of our own? The issue is not what the determination of the fact finder in the trial court was, but who should be the fact finder.
Well, actually, Justice Kelsey, I think that the problem with Brush Arbor is they put the cart before the horse. As Justice Kavanaugh said in the opinion that came out on Monday in interpreting the Federal Arbitration Act, but this court has also interpreted that, to be sure, before referring a dispute to the arbitrator, the court determines whether a valid arbitration agreement exists. So the predicate to determining whether there's arbitrability on any issue is there a valid arbitration agreement? Brush Arbor assumes there is. And what the decision of the trial court was very specific that there wasn't, because he had to look at the terms, and we have to remember that there's no presumption in favor of arbitrability or arbitration, and that's the Mission case decided by this court, and that the proponent of an arbitration agreement has the burden of proof of establishing that there was a valid agreement or enforceable agreement to arbitrate.
Counsel, the quote that you just gave from Schein, wasn't the full assertion that unless the parties agree otherwise, that it's an issue for the court unless the parties' contract provides otherwise?
Well, actually, I'll read the quote.
Maybe I'm in the wrong place.
Justice, and I will tell the court it's, I don't have, there are no page cites to it, but it's on page 6 of what I have that was printed off that we had sent. It says, this court has consistently held the parties may delegate threshold arbitrability questions to the arbitrator so long as the parties' agreement does so by, quote, clear, end quote, and clear and unmistakable, end quote, evidence, citing first options. To be sure, before referring a dispute to an arbitrator, the court determines whether a valid arbitration exists. Two pages later, he concludes in the second to last paragraph, under our cases, courts, quote, should not assume the parties agreed to arbitrate arbitrability unless there is clear and unmistakable evidence that they did so, end quote, again citing first options at 514 U.S. at 944. So back to the question, the threshold question is whether there was a valid or enforceable agreement to arbitrate, not whether who gets to decide arbitrability issues, but whether there was this agreement. And the issue that the court heard at an evidentiary hearing, and he drew a conclusion based on who had the burden, and the trial court said that the Brush Arbor had not met their burden of establishing a valid agreement to arbitrate. Because they had not established, though, and I thought it was very interesting as an advocacy, Mr. Sinkar got up and said that the arbitration agreement, and he read, you shall agree to arbitrate. However, that's not the complete phrase of the arbitration, and they had to prove.
Can I interrupt you again?
Yes, sir.
Distinguishing mutual mistake of fact from impossibility, isn't it fair to say that mutual mistake of fact can involve, and often does involve, an assumption that's mutually assumed prior to the formation of the contract that we later find out is just wrong, and then there's a whole host of rules of what you do about it. But impossibility is no, that we didn't make a false assumption. Something happened after the fact, and we just can't do this anymore. It doesn't work. It's not possible to be done. And that's impossibility.
Well, there's two answers to that question, Justice Kelsey. The first answer is that, and I think the trial court got it right as he explained, mutual mistake of fact, there was no evidence of the contract being being ambiguous or evidence of a mutual mistake of fact. And as he explained, the idea of a mutual mistake would be that we both meant to write AAA arbitration, but somehow when we negotiated it came out better business. That would be a mutual mistake of fact that would allow for revision of a contract. Impossibility, Justice, you asked a question which I think assumes that there's only one form of impossibility. But when we go back to Virginia Iron and we go back to Paddock v. Mason, I agree, an intervening act, and that's often the most common case of an impossibility, but this court has said, both in Paddock v. Mason and in Virginia Iron, that it's not only an impossibility that occurs when an intervening act makes something impossible, but whether the factors of an agreement didn't exist when the parties agreed to do something. And we've cited that specifically in the brief, and I can find it for the court, because the idea behind it is it's impossible, and so therefore you have a nullity. It's not a mutual mistake of fact that the court gets to decide what you intended.
But isn't that the problem? The moment you cross the line to the impossibility, you have a void contract. And if it's not severable, the whole thing is void, not just the provision for arbitration. But if you have a mutual mistake of fact, that's just an equitable question for a chancellor to discern whether or not it's reformed or whether it's unilateral or whether it's a mistake of fact or a mistake of law. It's a completely different legal analysis. And we may have blurred it in the past in our prior decisions, but if you can show us some precedent from the restatement or Williston or some conventional understanding of the doctrines that would reaffirm it, isn't it time to untangle those doctrines in Virginia?
Well, I don't think it's tangled that it needs to be untangled, Justice, and all due respect, I think it's very clear that if people make a non-performing agreement, then and it can't be enforced, that it's impossible. Therefore, they are not bound by the terms. And the question that you then said, you raised another issue that hasn't been raised before the court, and I'm not in a position to argue because it's not before the court on this appeal, is whether it's severability of the entire issue. Or is there a severability clause, if it it would be the whole contract is void or not. That wasn't raised, and it wasn't raised on appeal, and I'm not prepared to argue that in its entirety. I will concede with Justice Powell, though, that there is no evidence of a severability clause, so that the argument or the analogy that the appellants have tried to make in connection with Schuling, I don't think is applicable, because in that was a very factual and case-specific case. As a matter of fact, this court has also provided us interesting direction, and I cite the Schuling case because I think it's important. Where you have said that we have held that the statutory scheme enacted by the General Assembly favors the enforcement of arbitration agreements. However, that preference is not absolute. There is no provision in the statutory scheme prohibiting the parties from agreeing to limit the scope of its operation. Therefore, if I'm going to argue, if I were Brush Arbor and I wanted to argue the enforcement of an arbitration agreement, I have to, by evidence, meet the burden of establishing that there is an arbitration agreement, and it's not limited by the scope of the arbitration is not limited, the scope of its operation, by agreement.
When you were researching the case, did you find anything in Corbin or Farnsworth or the Restatement or Wilston or any of the major treatises that says what we allegedly said in a couple of our prior cases, which is impossibility can exist pre-formation, and that is an appropriate time frame in which to apply the doctrine? Because our most recent case, which was not too many months ago, applied the conventional view, which is impossibility is after performance begins, and then it can't work. It's post-formation, not pre-formation.
But Justice, I don't believe, if I'm recalling the case, and the court has obviously a greater memory, I don't believe it was an exclusivity issue. It can only be post-formation, impossible post-formation, and didn't exist pre-formation. But to answer your question directly, no, I didn't look at Wilston or Corbin and so forth. Frankly, I respect the precedent by this body, and I'm relying on Virginia Supreme Court case in Virginia Iron and the Virginia Supreme Court in Paddock v. Mason, which tell me that I can look at pre-formation. And this court didn't say, as a matter of rule, even if you adopt, say, we look at impossibility post-formation, you didn't say you never can. You didn't invalidate this prior precedent.
Okay, my question, though, is not that it's unfair for you to have done that. Of course you should, and precedent should be relied upon. But if precedent is being challenged as being an overreach, which is one of the challenges made here, we have to answer that. And if we've said something in a prior case that is wholly out of sync with orthodox principles of contract law, we should just own up to it, don't you think?
Well, I think that that's a. I don't think that that's a question, frankly, with all due respect, that I should be weighing in as to what owning up to, because that by the court, if there is a shift, obviously the court is going to inform us on that. I will ask the court to recognize, though, I think there's a corollary argument. I started out by saying that the threshold issue was there an agreement to arbitrate? Assume there is an agreement to arbitrate in this particular case. The question of where does the arbitrability go also is a question of fact for the trial court. And who that gets to decide the issue of arbitrability is a question of fact in this particular case. He heard the evidence, and what was the intent of the parties, because you can't just read the language and draw a conclusion that, as Justice Mims asked the question, was this negotiated, that they fully understand that it was not only just arbitration with whatever rules, but it was arbitration with very specific rules and how it was going to be done, and that was the term. Interestingly enough, in the couple of cases that are cited in the housing case, that was a federal case with arbitration where they said, we're going to use an arbitrator from anyone Dean Witter has used in the past, whatever rules they want to use. And so therefore the court indicated that, hey, wait, that's a general arbitration agreement, but there wasn't evidence in the arbitration itself that could lead to the interpretation of something very specific. In the Schuling case, very similar, this court said, well, the real issue, because it appeared on its face to argue that there was a specific term that was negotiated, what this court found was, well, but when you read it in the context, and the argument was made in the context of the severability clause, that context changes the world and allows someone to carve out a condition that is no longer valid. And that was an intervening act that occurred post-agreement. In this particular case, you have a contract, or a contract with a clause that has very specific terms, and the appellant had the burden of establishing either that was a general and this was a non-material element as to what rules and so forth to apply, and the court found that they didn't rise to that burden. They didn't meet that burden. They didn't. First of all, they didn't meet the burden
Let me ask you this. Justice Kelsey was asking about pre versus post, and one of my concerns is, as I read the case law generally, it seems like impossibility is the subject matter of the contract, here the building of a home, or you know the mining of ore or whatever, is just destroyed or impossible to perform. You know, there's supposed to be an opera performance, the opera house burned out. It's supposed to be a sale of a piece of art, it's been stolen. Here, it's not that the home couldn't be built or whatever. It's just one aspect of the contract, specifically dispute resolution. So it seems, and I just couldn't find cases that talked about just one isolated clause like that being impossible to perform as written, vitiated the entire contract. And so my concern is, I mean, there's all kinds of details in contract. Use Acme brand windows. Well, Acme goes out of business. Oh, impossibility. So with this expansive conception of impossibility, do we risk the destruction of all kinds of contracts versus just vitiating, you know, individual clauses? I was just trying to figure out where we police that line of impossibility. Is it the entire contract, or can we go clause by clause and say, oh, that's impossible, strike that?
Well, I think that requires a factual determination and examination of the contract, which is not in evidence, Justice McCullough, in the entire, because it wasn't moved into evidence, and we've already raised that argument. But more importantly, I think there's an issue. I don't think anyone says the whole contract has to go away, because as in any contract, the contract itself speaks for itself, and in any kind of contract, one can separately negotiate for different elements. I can have a master contract that says I'm going to build a house, and then I'm going to come in and I have a change order or a subpart of a change order that says I want wood doors here, and we're going to agree that I'm going to pay you $300 for those wood doors, you agree to deliver it. If you don't deliver the wood doors, or if we can't find wood doors because they only make those doors in aluminum, there may be an impossibility with regard to performing that term. That doesn't throw everything out. So you have to look at the contract as a whole, and what did the parties mean in the circumstances of reaching certain agreements as a whole, and we don't have a record. We don't have a record here. So we can't try to solve a general rule. I think that's one of the difficulties. I empathize with the court's desire to want to create a general rule to go forward. I don't think this is the case to do it, because we don't have a record. We don't have a transcript, and we don't know exactly what the court heard, what evidence was presented by both sides as the intent of the parties, what questions were asked, how he evaluated it. So when they have a burden...
Has he answered the question that you asked? Your time has expired.
I had 43 seconds, Your Honor, but I'll stop if you think about it.
You're 47 seconds over time.
Oh!
That's what the red light means.
I apologize.
That's quite all right.
Thank you very much for your consideration of this matter.
All right. Rebuttal.
First, with respect to the last exchange with my colleague, it sounded like an invitation that we had to have parole evidence to figure out what this contract is and says. And that goes against this court's precedence, particularly since the circuit judge here found that the contract was unambiguous. So this isn't a matter of fact. This is a matter of construing a contract that is not ambiguous. So there's no evidence required. With respect to the question of impossibility and mistake of fact, I think we have to keep in mind here, we're talking about doctrines that lift the obligation of contract performance. That's a big deal. And so the courts are reluctant to do this. And that's one of the reasons why, in the discussion with respect to the different consequences of impossibility and mutual mistake of fact, mistake of fact is a perfect remedy for the hypothetical, I think, Your Honor, that Justice McCullough gave, and that is that it's light on its feet. You can respond to say, okay, so the Acme windows are no longer there. We can reform the contract, because what did the parties want? What were the attributes of the Acme window that they wanted? So in terms of just dealing with the world of obligation of contract, impossibility is like the nuclear weapon.
Well, in the Capital One case a few months ago, we said it's the fortuitous destruction or character in the change of some essential portion of the contract. So it's a, it is a bit of a nuclear attack on a contract.
It is, and chronologically, I do think, logically, it, impossibility is something that happens after the parties have agreed. With respect to the argument about the adequate transcript and all that, this court has already rejected that argument in the motion to dismiss the appeal. I think it's been made about three times here. I'm just going to rest on our briefs on that. I don't think we need to address that. And again, with respect to no agreement to arbitrate, as analysis and Schuling points out, and that's one reason why I started my argument the way I did, that first clause of the arbitration agreement is the agreement to arbitrate. Everything else is what the courts have called procedural gateway into arbitration. So I think that's clear. Unless the court has any questions, I'm done.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Call the next case.